our time. We're uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and you're locked on to the UK's hottest politics and music podcast. Each week, I bring you the rawest takes on the big stories making the news, always joined by a very special guest. Then, I pleasure your mind, body, and soul with the freshest, most banging international music going.
Uncaged.
On today's episode, I am joined by an international music sensation who is not only going to be talking politics and current affairs with me, but he's also going to be talking about his music as well. This is huge. Pin back your eardrums and get ready for this. Dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, Free Flying with... My guest on this week's podcast is not only here for the news and politics section, but he's also going to hang around for the music section as well, because I've had to pinch myself, actually, to believe that I've got this man on. He is the frontman of rather legendary, world-famous band The Strokes. He's also of equally amazing band The Voids, but he is fast becoming a searingly sharp political voice in the musical landscape as well. It is a real honour to have him on. I'm really excited about this because I think it's going to be great. It's the incredible Julian Casablancas. Julian, thank you so much for coming on my podcast. It's a real, real pleasure to have you on.
Well, thanks for the craziest intro I think I've ever had, so appreciate that.
Excellent. I can write it down for you if you want and send it across to you.
No, it's okay. The memory is more precious.
Oh, you're too kind. Julian, we are going to talk about a lot of things today. As always with my podcast, we're going to start with the news and current affairs section. And we've got three stories which I want to touch on, but I want to use them as hooks to sort of get your worldview and some in-depth thought from you on certain issues. So we're using them as springboards, as it were. So we will crack on with this. The first story we're going to talk about is the Gilets Jaunes protests, the Yellow Jackets protests that are going on in France. They began, as many listeners will know, as a demonstration about President Macron and his diesel tax hikes, but they have evolved into something completely different. They are now anti-government, anti-corporation protests. Most recently this week, we had them coming out in support of International Women's Day on Friday. On the Saturday, there was another big protest down the Champs-Élysées. They've been blocking roundabouts. There seems no sign of these stopping, as it were. I mean, Julian, what's interesting for me about the Yellow Jackets movement is from its inception, it was very kind of apolitical. It was made up of components of the right-wing politics, the conservative politics in France. It was also then made up of elements of the left-wing and sort of anarchists as well. It was a broad spectrum of people with broad political beliefs. I mean, for you, do you think it's a kind of good example of how people can come together and put different political opinions aside to sort of really take on some of the most pressing issues of our day? Do you think it's working and a good example in that respect?
Whatever it takes to get that message across, I think is good. It seems like some of the activities and the protesting and all that seem good. I guess, I don't know, as long as the protests aren't... I think when protests get, like, violent, I guess that's when people always listen to the message a lot less. So I just remember early on, I think I saw, like protesters throwing things. Mm.
Yeah, that's kind of the long and the short of it, yeah.
Maybe that's changed. Maybe they're kind of more organized now. But I think... peaceful protests would probably be more powerful long term, and I think they're doing that. Though I've seen them do all sorts of things, so I don't want to generalize without the full story. But I think ideally they wouldn't elect a guy like Macron in the first place, or whatever, however you say his name. I feel like he was the obvious kind of vanilla corporate shill. So, yeah, so, I mean, I feel like, you know, elect those two kind of people, and if this movement will get that message across, I think, and awaken kind of people's understanding that, you know, that corporations are clearly grooming people like Macron to kind of help, you know, exploit, rape the earth. Yeah, the sooner things will start to turn around, I think. So, thumbs up, generally, I would say. I don't know. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but.
No, absolutely. I mean, you touched on a really interesting point there, actually, which was you kind of look at what happened in France, and as you say, I mean, they elected Macron when they had sort of two other polar political candidates. They had Michelon, who was the far left candidate, and then of course you had Marine Le Pen, who's the far right candidate. And you kind of sit back and think, after all these years of like neoliberal policies giving democracy away to corporations, putting power in their hands, that the kind of centrist kind of middle of the road Tony Blair, Bill Clinton politics has done, you'd think they would have learnt, and then they go and elect a middle of the road corporate centrist politician when they did kind of have a left-wing and a right-wing politician on the slate. I mean, it was kind of a bizarre situation for me. I don't know what you think about that.
I think the effectiveness is the dividing the right and left. You know, like whether it's Brexit or whether it's you know, making America great again, or all these kind of like so-called right-wing conservative kind of rallying cries are really. Essentially, I was thinking about the other day, it's essentially an excuse. It's like a brilliantly developed slogan so that billionaires can pay less taxes. It's kind of like all it is. So I feel like to get wrapped up in that kind of the right-left divisive thing is, yeah, I think I'm not even sure how much of the left in France is into the yellow jacket thing, but I know it's growing, but I think, yeah, essentially, if that's what you're talking about in terms of the ideas, you know, congealing, I think that, yeah, I think putting away the kind of social or, you know, like in America, it's abortion and gun rights and, or, you know, gay rights or whatever it is, kind of like putting that aside and agreeing, let's just figure out how to actually have democracy. Let's not argue over capitalism and socialism and all these kind of divisive words that basically are meaningless and people can twist to mean whatever they want. I think you just, like, let's agree that we want a system where I think democracy is still a good idea and can work. And, you know, and things like capitalism can work if it has other values, other important human values, other than just, you know, making money, and who cares if people die in the making of money. It's all about making money. So I think, I don't know, it's complicated in a way, but if it were all educated and understanding of what's happening with the divisive politics, and we can try to elect people who are, you know, more interested in the truth, then I guess it's following non-corporate candidates and non-corporate news, which is what this is and why it's so great. I think, you know, following independent journalists, or, you know, it's crazy. I mean, the biggest problem, I would say, is all the corporate media. It's really, it's such a brilliant tool to kind of divide people. And I think people just can't let go of it because it's just so well done. There's so much money behind it. There's the Superman lights and the Superman music and the laser show and the handsome news guy and the nightly news music. And it's just, well, that guy looks really serious, and it just, people can't detach from that. It's like a drug. They're so good at entertaining you and scaring you. But really, if you could somehow ignore that and kind of get to the bottom line of what the truth is, making the truth widespread is really the challenge. And, you know, if everyone could just be magically hit with a wand and understand some kind of collective baseline truth of what's going on, you wouldn't need elections. Everyone would kind of, like, Yellow Jacket style, take to the streets, and then power would kind of go to the people better suited who weren't, you know, betraying the public. But to get that right now going is real hard.
Yeah. No, I absolutely.
And I just derailed, but
no, you didn't derail at all. You're spot on. It is really hard, and I mean, you make a fascinating point about the sort of the issues with left politics and right politics. And as you quite rightly point out, this person's a socialist, and this person's a libertarian, or this person's a Democrat, or this bill, whatever. And I mean, it's especially, we're really like that in the UK. It's like, seriously, people are either a conservative, or they're a member of the Labour Party, or they're a liberal Democrat, or they're a Green, or they're what and the other. And it's like, sort of, politics hasn't caught up with the fact that, well, we're a bit kind of beyond that point now, you know. We're kind of a bit broken as a society, and we need politicians to firstly move beyond those static kind of polarized positions, and, as you quite rightly say, work in the interests of people other than corporations. And I think it's a challenge around the world at the minute.
Well, I mean, a concept that maybe could that would be nice, I think, is that you know, conservatives and progressives are different types of people, and I just think that humanity has, you know, survived and thrived with both of them. You know, both of them have a purpose and have a voice, and they should listen to each other in general. And the best solutions come from some kind of, you know, mixture. I think, you know, early times, there was any kind of drama or you know, tragedy or you know, like a drought or some kind of, you know, some kind of societal problem, I think there was always one group that was like, let's try the new thing, or let's go beyond the mountains, check out new lands, and some would want to, like, let's stay put and wait it out. And I think there's general attributes of each that are, you know, valuable, and, you know, being cautious versus risk-taking, or but there's also being open-minded versus being traditionalist. And I think generally those two things can govern a society in an intelligent way, and you don't have to, like, hate a conservative person if you're liberal or vice versa. But I think to understand that we should have a system where progressives and conservatives can actually decide what we want to do, as opposed to just being completely powerless, and the whole system is just designed to essentially have billionaires pay no taxes. That's essentially the game. It's just billionaires want to pay no taxes, and everything else is like, you know, this kind of, it's a joke, like what the left or the immigrants and the, it's not about the immigrants. It's not, I mean, that there might be an issue there. Let's just say you want to, you know, protect, you know, I mean, I personally would believe, since I'm more progressive, I would say, well, you should figure out why do people want to, like, come in your country, and they're coming from a miserable place. Like, maybe, like, let's not contribute to things that make it miserable, because people don't naturally want to leave their country. So that would be how I approach it, and I understand that that's more progressive. But the point is that it's not really about that. They just want to pay less tax. They want, billionaires want to make more money, and this is how they do it. They fund people who kind of will say stuff that will win elections, and then behind closed doors, you know, slash their taxes. And it's really not more complicated than that. So I feel like, yeah, democracy, whether you're on the right or left, should be the number one goal.
You know what? You've hit the nail on the head, really, because it isn't any more bloody complicated than that. That is the bottom line. It's about a sort of small group of people who are religiously intent on getting wealthy, and at the detriment to the rest of us. And that's ultimately, as you say, you can take all the sort of here today, gone tomorrow issues. You can take the issues, as you quite rightly point out, like immigration, where even the progressives sometimes aren't really asking the right questions, as it were. And it does boil back down to that again. I mean, you touched on earlier the corporate media, which is a big kind of, it's a big issue for me, hence why I write for the outlet and I broadcast for the outlet I do. It's a major bugbear of mine. I want to kind of go in on that a bit now. I mean, the biggest news story about kind of the corporate media in the UK this week was the fact that Facebook has been shutting down pages left, right and centre again. This is sort of Facebook's favourite thing at the minute, shutting down anyone who doesn't agree with the corporate agenda. And this was publicised on Thursday of this week, and it was basically shut down some far-right sites, it shut down some anti-vaccination sites. It also shut down some anti-far-right sites, which were opposed specifically to a guy in this country called Tommy Robinson, who is he styles himself as a like far-right soothsayer, almost like some kind of sage when it comes to the politics of this country. And these were sort of anti-far-right progressive sites that Facebook has shut down. This has been going on for ages now, and we keep seeing it. Facebook is doing this sort of on repeat, really, as it were, as are other platforms. I mean, does it concern you, this kind of censorship, be it censorship of progressive sites, or, by the same token, censorship of conservative right-wing sites? Does this censorship concern you?
Yeah, it's depressing. I mean, it's been happening for a while. I mean, Facebook clearly is not the good guy. I can't tell where there's like the naive trying to do the right thing, and maybe like they watch too much mainstream media, or versus like insidious, like, you know, corporate deals being done behind closed doors. It's maybe some kind of mixture of both. I don't know. But essentially, yeah, I think there is like this kind of the new big tech, you know, they're kind of like bordering on like the new robber barons almost of society, where, you know, once they have a lot of, you know, wealth and power, it seems like they're not necessarily doing the right thing. But yeah, I mean, I think for me, the kind of things that would have to happen, there is an order, I suppose. And I think, like I said, kind of, you know, getting the truth out there, trusting independent candidates and media more than anyone who's corporately funded, I think is kind of step one in a way. And I just think that essentially there should be no such thing as deception. You shouldn't be allowed in politics and press. I find it weird that you're allowed to lie. So I think that there could be, I think there should not be any censorship of, you should be able to say whatever you want. It shouldn't be taken down, but there should be some kind of theoretical panel. The thing is, you can't get a panel that you can agree on is made of, I mean, if it was like jurors, like a jury system, something like that, and maybe, you know, they could like hear the evidence of both sides and decide what something is. But first, obviously, you need a democracy in place that you can trust first. But eventually, if you're looking down the line, I would say a thing where if there is news that's designed to kind of, that is funded by corporations and kind of, you know, leaves out certain things, it needs to be labeled as like entertainment news, or, you know, corporate news, that, or like, you know, if they lied about something, it's like they have a truth rating or something like that. And if you're saying crazy stuff, you know, it could be like, you know, not like fake news or whatever like kind of warning label you would have, but they should be allowed to say it nonetheless. 'Cause then, like you said, it could be someone saying the truth and they're being labeled. But if really it's done in a way where it's like it's not a bad guy shutting down truthsayers, you should let everyone say what they want to say. Unless, you know, it's like, whatever, how to build a bomb or how to, you know, those kind of like specifically damaging things. I mean, there's those limits in society everywhere. So, I don't know if that answered that.
That did, and yeah, I mean, that's a delicious proposition, having truth ratings on the news. My God. Can you imagine like what Fox and CNN would be like? Good grief! That would be that.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, yeah, and also just a label if you're independent, you know, some kind of thing showing that this person is just, you know, maybe he'll just want ratings. So you never know; they might say crazy things to just want ratings. But if they're not getting corporate money, you know that ratings is not as important. So I think it's just important things that people should know, and they don't. So
no, I absolutely agree, and you're spot on. I mean, it concerns me. I say it concerns me. It's one of my biggest concerns, really, that there's a group of people in society who are, I suppose, what you would say woke, if you like, and are switched on both sort of consciously and socially, and sort of who know what's what, who are aware of the sort of malign influence of corporate media and corporations more broadly and how they impose upon our systems of democracy. But it concerns me that that kind of group, while it probably has grown over the years, is still rather small, and that the majority of the population are just, as you sort of very eloquently painted earlier on, are just almost mesmerized by corporate news, with, as you put, the handsome guy presenting it and the sort of jingles, and they're almost under its spell, if you like. I mean, I sometimes think, in the age of the internet and with so much access to information at our fingertips, that you'd think its power would be lessening, as it were. But I don't think it is. I think it's polarizing groups of society, in terms of that the group of people who are aware and who are conscious and woke are becoming more so. But then everyone else is almost becoming less consciously aware and almost kind of a bit zombified. Do you recognize what I'm saying there?
Yeah, no, well, totally. I think the thing is that they play the internet game. They're trying to, you know, that's why people don't know where to go. That's why they're still kind of, you know, watching the news sometimes, because I think another thing that would be important would be anonymity online, I think, is an unhealthy thing. I mean, you could have specific sites where people want to be anonymous, that's fine. But just to be able to kind of, you know, whether it's bots or trolls or whatever, they really, like, that operation is probably as important as the mainstream media. So I think if there was some kind of law or system where, you know, every single comment was, you know, traceable to a real person, I think that would help if you couldn't just be anonymous and say things, or you know, fake accounts were all exposed, etc. I think if that was kind of more of a thing, that would help, because right now, you know, like, you go to someone writes an article, and it could be, again, if it's on an indie left-wing site, chances are it has a small community and they don't care. But if it ever gets to the point where it's a popular thing that's like spreading truth, I mean, the army, the troll bot army, comes out in force. And I think if you're on the fence about something and you see an enlightening news story, and then you read all the comments and they're like, when has socialism ever worked, or whatever the things that they say, it kind of makes you go, oh wow, everyone really hates this guy. Like, people are like, people, everyone reads the comments, you know what I mean? That's just something that they figured out early on, and that's like a big part of their game. So I think they go online and they get confused. So I think another part of the transparency needs to be with how the internet is run.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're spot on about the situation with bots, especially. I mean, there's been in the UK, there's been a massive hoo-ha over something called the Integrity Initiative, which was a think tank. It wasn't really a think tank. It was a sort of psyop by the UK government. And our government paid this think tank the sum of £2 million to effectively spread Twitter propaganda about the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn. It all came out in Parliament. They were forced to admit they'd done this. If you want to use the restroom, as they say in the US, or as we say in London, the lavvy, then go now, because me and Julian will be back in a second talking more about technology and moving on to Venezuela as well. I mean, we've kind of, as a species, we've kind of put ourselves in such a conundrum, really, because we have become so advanced in terms of our technological capabilities and what we can do, and the sharing of information, but we haven't yet caught up with ourselves as a species to do that for the right reasons. We still allow ourselves.
It goes up and down. I mean, I agree, it's like a little bit of a, in terms of values, I think it's a little bit of a dark moment. But I think, like you see in France, I think things might rebound. I mean, I think what it comes down to is values. It's like things like, for example, deception. Like, you know, in the news and politics, deception is allowed. And I feel like that, it's almost like a missing, like, commandment. I feel like we've had these kind of, humanity needs to take this kind of, like, spiritual step where it's like, where we focus on how a society can work like a community, where if it's a small community, you won't just, you know, one guy won't be allowed to be like, I own the lake and poison it in the meantime, and just kind of, you know, everyone will just kind of run this guy out of town, basically, you know what I mean? And now, you know, you get a pat on the back if you do something like that because you're a brilliant, you know, exploiter. So I think what I'm getting at is that, if yeah, like, no deception and, or like, you know, thou shalt not exploit or whatever, because in business, again, it's confusing. If you're, whether you're a mob leader or whatever it is, if you're like a rich, successful, at least in America culturally, it's like you made it, you know, and it doesn't matter how or what you did. It's just kind of like, well, that's the goal, is wealth. And I think, yeah, I don't know. It's just like a value system. We can have capitalism. You can have, I just think, like I said, it needs to be more in balance with other things. You know, like where you're not, you know, hurting others or whatever. Like, we, it's the same concept as we have freedom, right? But we can't shoot people and steal stuff, right? There's like, we have freedom, but you can't cross the line and hurt someone. I think those same simple kind of human values are completely like lost as the world has kind of become, you know, with the internet and business becoming such a global phenomenon. I think we've kind of left certain values behind, and I think if we can culturally kind of, you know, pump them back in, I think a lot of these things will be fixed automatically. But I guess, yeah, the kind of value of just making money at the expense of others is something that definitely needs to be absorbed and understood better, I think. Because right now we just compute it as like, well, companies are good, you know, trade is natural to man, and communism is bad. So, sure, those things are true and fine, or I agree with them, but that's not the end. That's not, that's the argument that people use, again, to like exploit, as opposed to get to the bottom of how to actually improve things.
No, absolutely. And I think with regards to values, you're absolutely spot on. I mean, it's a pertinent issue over here at the minute as well. In London, we've got what's being called a kind of knife crime epidemic. We've got lots of politicians, because young people keep stabbing each other. We've got lots of politicians saying, oh, well, it's lack of police. Or if you're a left-wing politician, you say it's lack of political education, or it's lack of youth services or whatever. And there's left-wing views and there's right-wing views. And no one really wants to say, well, is it not in part the fact that the values of sort of greed and avarice and jealousy have sort of overtaken us in some respects as a species, because we're so conditioned to want more and want wealth. Yeah. And is that really not kind of one of the roots of why people go around murdering each other? Maybe that we need to regain some values?
Yeah, that plus income inequality, yes.
Yeah,
I would say
exactly, absolutely. I mean, that, your sort of talk of values and whether left or right is wrong kind of leads me into the final issue I want to touch on. But again, we'll talk in broad strokes with this. It is the ongoing situation in Venezuela now. I mean, the impartial backdrop to this is that President Nicolas Maduro is a divisive figure in his country. Mr. Guaido elected himself as president-elect earlier in the year with the backing of the United States. And, of course, this story has rumbled on. Now, not to polarize the issue, if you're on the left, it's viewed as another corporate-backed coup by America. If you're on the right, is of course, it is bringing democracy to a country which has been under the rule of socialism for many years. They're the sort of basic views of this situation. It's obviously big news in the US. Your media may paint it slightly differently to the way ours paint it. I mean, what's your broad kind of take on what's happening in Venezuela? Where do you sit on that?
It's hard. I mean, I haven't been there, so I don't, you know, it's hard to say when you haven't been. But I think that the discussion in the media of at least America is absurdly one way. And if you asked me personally about, like, you know, coups in South America and how they've evolved in this day and age, I would say, well, it's still happening. Look at Venezuela, for sure, because it's the same exact kind of playbook. You know what I mean? It's like when we talk about the thing, I mean, it comes back to, again, another important thing is history and collective truth. And what we agree is collective truth and kind of what we study as history to stop making the same mistakes. I mean, I was listening to the radio and I was listening to, like, the way, like, you know, Tiberius, like, you know, wanted land reformed and was murdered by the conservative, like, you know, this is, like, you know, thousands of years ago, and it's just, like, things that we still aren't able to really learn from and just keep repeating over and over again. So my point is, if you're going to talk about history, we don't agree on history in the first place. So I, you know, have studied all, like, these kind of South American coups, I would call them. I think they're acknowledged as coups now. You don't really learn that at all in school. So I don't know. Maybe people would argue that they were coups. I don't know. But the way that I learned them is that America doesn't like a leader because he's not playing nice. He's not, like, giving them the sweet business deal that the other corrupt leader was. So they decide to, they fund opposition. They create, like, economic sabotage, economic war, destroy the country, fund press that talks badly about the leader. And then basically, you know, he'll naturally be overthrown, and if not, sometimes they'll give him a little nudge or whatever. So that's how I study it. If we agree on that, then I don't see how what's happening in Venezuela is different. I feel like I was like, I mentioned something about it, and just the kind of the outpouring of people that were just like, you don't know what it's like here, it's like miserable, like how could you say, like all this shit. And I don't know if it was earnest or trolls or what, but I just, yeah, there's no denying that the situation is terrible. And you could argue, even if it's America sabotaging the government, whatever, we need a better choice. Like, I get that. But the issue that I had, the only single issue that I was talking about was specifically the media in America didn't even really mention that, like, that America is, you know, I mean, I guess they mentioned sanctions, but there's not a clear picture of what America is trying to do. And I think it's obvious. And I always feel like I wish there was more honesty. If they can't be honest, if they're doing it in the name of national security, like if some general could theoretically just show up on the show right now and say, and argue and say, you know, well, if we don't control the oil, then like the economy collapses and then the other countries can attack us. Whatever like argument you want to make, I feel like, fine, if you believe that it's in our national security, then just be honest about it. You know, I feel like, again, democracy, if we had democracy and you let people decide, I think if you give people the facts, they can be trusted. So, you know, if you want to explain, like, we need their oil, like, this is a bad country, they're friends with Russia, and they're going to, like, you know, cause problems. If you want to give an argument of why these people shouldn't be in power, that's one thing. But to just, like, lie about it is my problem with it. You know what I mean? Just to say, like, look at how bad the country is doing when it's like all these economic... I mean, it seems to me like it's the corporate entities in Venezuela that want to be in power and can't win elections, tag-teaming with America who wants their oil. I mean, it seems pretty simple. But things are bad, so maybe, you know, you can argue that you want to change. My argument was just that the press... It's simple. The press in America was just completely one-sided, and I find that very weird. And I guess maybe it's more two-sided in England because maybe they're less of a player in it, so they could be a little more honest about it maybe. I don't know. So I'm not saying I like Maduro. I don't follow his – I mean, I don't know. Again, I'm not there. I don't know enough about it. Officially, I don't want to, like, you know – I don't want to say that I'm an expert on it. I think that, again, lack of historical collective truth agreement and lack of honesty from the press are two issues that are hard for me to ignore in this situation.
No, that's spot on in my opinion. My position is extremely similar to yours. This is a coup. I mean, it's essentially, it's out of the sort of textbook, as you say, you can go back sort of hundreds of years, but in more modern times, it's out of the sort of textbook of Guatemala in the 1950s with the United Fruit Company, which America has been playing out ever since, with sort of the Chicago school boys in Chile, to the situation in Iraq, to Afghanistan, to Libya, to Syria, which failed, and now, of course, in Venezuela. It is, naturally it is. I mean, Venezuela have the largest known oil reserves on the planet. So, it's, I mean, it's, and it beggars belief that the media can still sell it as something else. They can.
That's the thing that blows my mind.
It blows my mind. It's completely worked.
Everyone is. I remember reading about these coups, like, you know, when I was deepest in it was maybe, I don't know, 7-ish years ago or something, and there was like Honduras still, but, and there was still, and Brazil happened, and I thought, wow, it can still happen in this modern day and age. They just remove someone democratically elected because the corporations don't like them. And now there's the Venezuela thing, and it just seems like, I guess I was learning these things in a bubble. I just assumed with the internet and these ideas were kind of getting around more, but it just, nobody has learned or seems to notice or care. And so, yeah, it's depressing, and that's why I don't watch mainstream news.
Yeah, no, quite. I mean, and it is. It's we're so, that, I mean, there's so many sort of scenarios and so many different situations going on in the world at the minute, but as a sort of collective sum of their parts, in many respects we are so far down the rabbit hole, it's just unbelievable. Of course, it goes back to, again, what we were talking about earlier, the malign influence of the corporate media, who have as much vested interests in getting into Venezuela as the US oil oligarchs would. I think my point was earlier that what we have in the UK is a tendency to, with the left-wing press, a lot of, not so much the mainstream left-wing press, but more independent left-wing press, paint Maduro as some kind of sort of socialist saviour, which, for me, he's actually not really. We get a kind of skewed narrative from both independent and mainstream, for me, personally, over here. Like I say, the real people for me stuck in the middle are the people living in poverty, which, as you rightly point out, they're in poverty not because of Maduro necessarily, but because of US sanctions. I mean, this has been rumbling away for goodness knows how many
years. My problem is, I haven't, like, let's say you want to argue that Maduro is bad, and I would say, okay, let's just say he is for a second, or let's just say he is. My issue is, I have yet to hear someone who says he's bad that, like, kind of also says, like, well, yes, American sanctions are causing problems and we're doing it because he's so bad. Like, it's just like they just don't mention that. So I'm like, but the fact that you don't mention it makes me, like, a little suspicious of what you're saying. So that's my kind of thing. I mean, I'm not, you know, denying that there's a lot of, you know, suffering going on there. So I hate to just belittle it from the comfort of here or sound like I'm doing that. I'm just saying it's hard to kind of assess what's true. And I think that, yeah, that would be the cure of all, is kind of figuring out how to establish some kind of a collective truth. And it probably starts with democracy. I don't know, actually, who knows how it starts? I mean, it could be something like the Yellow Jackets that blows up, or you don't know what it is or how it might happen, but it needs to happen, I think, for sure.
No, absolutely. No, I don't think you were belittling at all, actually. I think you fit the nail on the head, because, as you say, it is about truth. And if the truth comes out that it doesn't fall on the one side of the political fence or the other side of the political fence, that it sits somewhere in the middle of both those things, then so be it, you know. But as you say, we should have the whole picture.
But the online war, I'm saying, the online war we were talking about, the way, like, people will comment or attack you, they'll just say, Julian supports Maduro, what a fucking asshole. And then, or people, you know, we're suffering or whatever, like, and if, or, you know, when has socialism ever worked, you know, and all these things. And if you address those things and say, well, I don't know, Denmark or something, and you say, I don't support Maduro or whatever, and you're always, like, backtracking, and then they'll just be like, well, what the fuck does he know? He's a fucking billionaire. I don't, like, it just, they'll, they will just assassinate people's characters. They don't even have to, like, it's just like that's the way they win the battle. So truth is just so far away from anything. And anyway, sorry, I just wanted to add that for no reason, I guess.
No, you had every reason to add it. You're spot on. And it's has sort of politics and political movements, has it now become too polarized? Is that what the issue is? I mean, you talk of, you're not sure how we could overall, looking at the three subjects we've discussed and sort of what we've discussed off them, I mean, overall you say that you're not sure what could sort of be the spark that begins to solve this. Do you think there is going to be anything that is going to solve it, or are we just too now polarized and entrenched in certain positions for it to be fixable? What is there hope?
I think net neutrality is a big, I think, component to that. I think that's why the censorship and the closing of sites and stuff is scary. I think if the internet maintains its kind of, you know, freedom, for lack of a better word, I think anything is possible. But I think if the world becomes, you know, how China and Russia have the internet on lockdown, if that happens, and it's basically happened via corporations in America-ish, not like 100% clamped down, but close to. So it's scary, and it's maybe near, and maybe I'm sleeping and it's here already. Rhyme intentional. But I think as long as there is the internet, I think enlightenment is possible, but it, you know, would have to be kind of simple and sexy on some level.
That's such a, that's kind of, I half want to chuckle and half want to go, oh shit, he's so right, isn't he? That wraps up this section actually quite nicely, Julian. Simple and sexy is sadly how it probably is going to have to be. Fascinating insights, really, really interesting to hear your opinions on some of these things. And we will be back in a few minutes. We're going to be discussing the voids and more politics, I think. So don't go anywhere, join us in a few minutes. Go on then, grab yourself a tea, coffee, or your favourite tipple, because me and Julian will be back to talk about the voids up next. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. Yes, my fantastic guest Julian Casablancas is back for the music section as well. Of course he's going to be back for the music section, because he is a international legend when it comes to the music industry. Obviously frontman of the massive Strokes, who nearly everyone surely on this planet must know at least one of the Strokes songs, if not more. But he has made a even more blistering return last year in 2018 with his new project, new band, The Voids. Julian, I want to just briefly, let's talk about The Voids for a second and how the band and the project came into being. Because you were kind of, you were off starting a solo project, weren't you? And then The Voids kind of happened. What happened there? What's the story behind The Voids?
Well, quickly after I did a solo thing, it wasn't really my intention to do solo things. I always felt like The Strokes was the main thing that I was doing and was happily fulfilled and whatever. So there was certain frictions and turmoils and resentments and band blah 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 BS. Anyway, so time has healed all wounds, but I think essentially at the time I did a solo thing, and as soon as I started rehearsing for shows, I realized, oh, this is how I like writing music, like in a room with people, and then you can just instantly, you know, this should be faster and this part should be shorter. And because I had done it kind of just with a producer alone, kind of how I had always done demos but not an album. Anyway, so I quickly began a quest for people who could be on my musical wavelength and friends to do that with, to write with. And that's just took about 4 years to really find the whole team.
That's quite a long time, actually. It's very interesting, and I think that then comes out the backstory and the length of time it took to put the voids together. It comes out in your first album, which was released last year, which is, of course, Virtue. Now, I'm going to hold my hands up here and make a confession to you that kind of alternative rock is not a natural bedfellow of mine, Julian, I'm afraid. It's not the first music I would go to. I'm more of a, I'm kind of more urban. However, I have to say, I put this on, hit play, and I was immediately like, yes, this is actually my kind of shit. I really, really, really like this. And do you know why I liked it? Because it is so eclectic musically. It's absolutely, it's fascinating. It's quite mind-blowing, actually, musically, in so many different ways, not least the sort of production and the mastering. It's done in such a way that, for me, as a listener myself, personally, it almost felt like a kind of underground, independent record. The production and the mastering is really, really interesting on it. But it's the eclecticism of the songs. I mean, you go from a track like Pyramid of Bones, which I almost got Black Sabbath kind of vibe going on there with that bit. And then Alienation, which you've got the hip-hop drums going on, and then you've got this sort of strutting bass line. You then go to the amazing track, Think Before I Drink, which I want to talk about a bit later, and immediately I was transported to Bob Dylan. Your vocal on that especially is absolutely stunning. And then Pink Ocean, kind of 80s electronic almost. This eclecticism, which is absolutely just so transfixing as you listen to it, it really is. The whole album, just you are shell-shocked in some respects, but also transfixed in another. Throughout this album, then, it also showcases beautifully your amazing vocal range. Again, a track by Permanent High School, singing this rich tenor voice.
Be damned, don't you dare, I'll be laughing from here to there. Just because something's popular don't mean it's good.
And then you flip it up again in when we go to something like Pink Ocean with this sort of soaring, extremely controlled falsetto. It's just, like I say, it wasn't a natural bedfellow for me, for my musical taste. But as soon as I put it on, I was like, yeah, this is absolutely amazing. It's a genius piece of work in so many ways. It really is. It's absolutely stunning. Was this eclecticism? Because it is, and it's eclecticism, but it's also very experimental in a lot of respects, listening to it for me. Was this a conscious decision to make it like this, or is this just how you and the other band members kind of came together and what came out of the pot, as it were? Which is it, if there is a sort of method behind the wonderful madness?
Well, I mean, thank you for all that. That was pretty epic. I think, yeah, you kind of nailed it. I mean, well, like I said, finding people where we're all on the same wavelength was a big part of it, and kind of could be able to like create the things you like also. And I think, like you said, what do you have when you have people who like, I mean, we all like hip hop, we all like Black Sabbath, we all like 70s and 80s like African and, you know, Arabic funk, and we also, you know, like classic rock things too. So I think, yeah, when you have all those, especially the drummer Alex is like, he's like, I mean, he's just like a human kind of drum machine. I mean, it's just the beats. Like, I used to always write drum beats, and then now that I met him, I just basically don't.
Yeah, the drums are epic on it. Yeah, he's absolutely fantastic. It's just, yeah, amazing skills there.
Yeah, so I think we play all kinds of music, you know, it's the same, and we're just always jamming too. I mean, sometimes we'll play something that sounds like a Prince song, and sometimes we'll play something that sounds like a metal song. So yeah, it just kind of goes all over the place.
It does, but it's a natural kind of all over the place as well, because tracks like We're Where We Were, it's kind of, there's punk in that. I was immediately like, yeah, this needs to be played in London. And then the last track, Pointlessness, Am I Allowed to Say, and you can sort of shoot me down in flames if you want. I always felt like it was a bit kind of, there's a bit of glam rock going on. It's kind of like, really, can I say that? Or are you offended now?
No, I'm not offended. I haven't really, don't really hear that.
No?
There's an element of something that we try to capture that... is like movie score,
yeah.
Sometimes, yeah. And I think that's kind of, it's hard to, trying to put that into a song is always tricky. So I don't know.
No, but that's that's exactly what came across. It was this huge kind of bold, very landscape. It's just, yeah, a huge, and it was movie score. That's exactly what it was. It was intense. It was dramatic. But like, for me, I kind of felt like it was that sort of intensive showmanship of glam rock, which is coming across music. It shows, like I say, I mean, it feels natural, but a very sort of intentional naturalness. What also came across to me with the whole album, it's quite a dark album. I can't sit here and go, oh yes, it's all rainbows and fluffy bunnies and unicorns. It's a dark, in a lot of respects, brooding piece of work, and we'll talk about the sort of politics behind it more in a moment. But I mean, there's an artist, a reggae roots artist called Protégé, who was nominated for the Reggae Grammy this year, and he produced an album called Matter of Time, and that was an extremely dark project as well. And I interviewed him last year, and he said that it was like that because that's where he is at personally at the moment. He's not, his worldview and his outlook on things and the state of society isn't all happy and positive and what have you. It's fairly dark. I mean, is the sort of darkness of the album, the brooding kind of nature, is that a reflection of where you and the band are at again, or was it an intentional kind of move to make an album like that?
I think I've always been attracted. I've always liked dark things. I think a lot of us in the band too. Beardo will always talk about how he's always attracted by the dark side of things. Yeah, I've always liked dark movies and dark music, and to be honest, there's been a thing of like a lot of the things that sometimes when it comes to like metal and stuff, like I would really love like the kind of, I guess that's why, you know, in the era that I grew up in, I guess bands like Nirvana and kind of grunge, if you will, was kind of like a big thing, because it was, had that kind of like hard energy, but like was actually like musically cool too, because sometimes it seemed like in some respects with some kind of harder music, you kind of give that up in a sense for just being like, who can be the hardest and the toughest? But so yeah, it's a fine line. I mean, Black Sabbath is probably the kind of the lighthouse of kind of hard but musically cool, the kind of guiding light or whatever, however you want to say it, the trailblazers. But then there's also like rhythmic elements and things like African music and hip hop that are kind of, you know, like lacking to me, and sometimes in like, you know, indie rock. So yeah, and it's a fine line to not, you know, there's a lot of traps when you're kind of blending genres. There's a lot of a lot of bad ways to go. So I think over time, I think I've developed enough kind of taste and listened to enough cool things that we kind of avoid anything cheesy in those pursuits. But but yeah, I think whether it's like gangster rap or, you know, punk or metal or, you know, just sad songs, I think I've always been attracted to that. But it's also nice to be uplifting. I mean, I'm moved personally by sad things, you know. Something really, like, powerfully well done sad will actually kind of cheer me up. So I think that's a pretty universal thing. So it's not just about, like, brooding or you know, be sad or anything. But I think that, if especially if you're feeling pain or sometimes when music is too shiny, sometimes it just doesn't talk to you and it just... you need to kind of get to that dark place to really, like, reach people sometimes. So, I don't know. The point is uplift and inspiration, but, yeah, sometimes it comes from dark places.
No, I think you have, I mean, there's numerous balances that you have struck. As you say, it's a fine line you tread sometimes when you do sort of the eclecticism of mashing up of genres, not, as you say, not to fall into traps with it, and you haven't done that at all. Like, Alien Nation is a perfect example. I mean, you can tell by the drum beats and that kind of strutting bass line that it's sort of grounded, there's elements of hip hop in there, but you've used that so masterfully that you haven't fallen into the trap which some artists do of making it an overtly hip hop track, which would feel completely out of place on the album. It's synced in extremely well. And you're right what you say about how dark tracks can be uplifting, because that's why Think Before You Drink stood out for me. I mean, it's an extremely moving track. In so many respects, and immediately grabbed me, and both emotionally and lyrically as well. The way you've put it together, it's very stripped back. It's a really moving track. It's very hard to sum it up. And
it's funny, we tried so many. It was like the first version. It's like I kept trying to add things, and like I got this guy who's like from Palestine, and he played this crazy instrument. I forget the name now, but. We tried so many different, like, things, and it just ended up being the first thing. But it's a cover song. It was a song I heard on the radio. Very weird song. Very weird band. I don't know if you were familiar with the original version.
No, I didn't realize it was.
Well, I mean, I kind of, like, changed the words a little bit around, but it was just one of those rare... It's very rare to hear a protest song where the lyrics are... cool. I've always searched similar again with, like, you know, metal that's, like, you know, really, like, musically interesting and powerful and quality and all that. So it's like these kind of like white whales or whatever, but this song was so weird, but the lyrics, I were like, oh wow, these are political lyrics, but they're not annoying, which is so rare. And so that's kind of how I got the idea of doing a cover of it, because if you hear the original, pretty strange. And I've always been in, my rule with covers is if it's like a great version of a song, you know, you don't want to touch it, you know. It's like you never cover Bohemian Rhapsody or something. But if a, you know, a song like the Joe Cocker Help From My Friends is like the perfect, you know, like a song secretly is good but just kind of played a little weird, is the kind of ideal candidate for cover. So it's a little bit that situation. I love the lyrics and the version. I mean, even though I do like the version, I think his voice is pretty strange. He wasn't a band. He was like a spiritual guy who, like, got together, and like a 70s guru in California got musicians together and just did an album kind of for fun or something. So it's pretty weird.
Well, you've recovered it masterfully. Like I say, for me, it's the standout moment of the album. The other standout moment is Pyramid of Bones. I mean, it's a very clever track for starters. But again, it's the way it's constructed, and I mean, musically, it's outstanding. But it's the content of it. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're referring to, it's sort of about the slavery and then the civil rights movement in the US, and that kind of sets this sort of protest and political nuance behind the song, sets the theme of the whole album, really, because it's a very politically motivated album. As I say, Pyramid of Bones, you discuss that. Alien Nation is discussing at length sort of corporate imperialist US. You then flip to, again, Think Before You Drink is, as you said, the original, I assume, was about how the education system indoctrinates us. Because there's a wonderful line in that where it says, "Where my teachers gave me poison and I drank it like a fool." I mean, it's a brilliant line, and it's so true about the odd state education system that we have. But I mean, like I say, overall, heavily political, lots of messages and themes going on there. I mean, when you write music, is the message the thing that comes first and the priority for you, or is it the music itself and then the message follows that? Which kind of order does it go in for you? Does that make sense?
I think they kind of, it's a little symbiotic, symbiotic, I don't know how to say that word.
That's correct.
I think I write lyrics down all the time. I'll think of something and I'll write. So I have like a lot of lyrics that are just musicless words. But jamming words into song, cool lines, it's like the way a line, something that I've learned over the years is the way lyrics work melodically it's such a kind of nuanced, it's almost magical. I feel like I have an actual clear understanding now of like what works and what doesn't, but it's kind of irrelevant. You could take the best lyrics and the best poetry and if it doesn't, it can just sound like just terribly, hit you terribly cheesily, or you know, and vice versa. You can say something really dumb and simple, but with the right melody, the way it bounces off of, and the accents of the words, it can really be powerful and moving and feel like this deep kind of this deep transcendent thought, even though you're just saying like, "Ooh, I'm not doing it," you know. And it's just kind of powerful, where if he said, like, "to be or not to be," you just want to, like, shut it off and you know. So it is a whole kind of dance. And a lot of the times when you're working on music, what you will naturally say, a lot of those things will kind of stick more than a concept you're trying to jam into it. So I think a song like Pyramid of Bones, it was Jake has a deep voice and he always does like a Paul Robeson impression, you know, like the famous 40s. He was one of the rare kind of entertainers and political people, and or a big fan of his. And so he was doing a fake, "Don't you listen to the white man lie," you know, like kind of like he was singing some kind of old. So it was rhythmically done in that thing, and we had the riff, the kind of Black Sabbath-y riff. So again, those things, they just kind of mash together and work together naturally. And I think the best lyrics are when you're working on a concept and you're working on a song, and then you kind of it naturally kind of fall into place, where you're not forcing. Like it's very fascinating. The accents of words is the same as. It's if you say a word with an accent, weird, like tow truck or something like that. You know what I mean? If you say accents is such a silent part of language, and I think that's there is accents in melodies too. So if if the melody is like we will like rock you, it's like the accent is like on rocky, and if you say a sentence where the accent is on the first words, but the musical accent is on the latter words, that's when lyrics sound bad, generally. So that's part of the puzzle. I don't know if that helps explain it or not.
No, it does perfectly, and it shows why you're such an accomplished artist, for having that that insight. I mean, it stands out in the album, especially Alien Nation is another standout track, but I'm not going to give too much away because people obviously need to go and listen to this album if they haven't already. It's, as I keep saying, it's very political and there's a lot of messages in there. I mean, for me, what a lot of my work entails is interviewing artists who I would call conscious, but what may more broadly be known as kind of protest artists, if you like. They release songs which have political messages to say and social messages. A lot of my work is with reggae artists because kind of the roots reggae movement is very, very big. It's based on sort of Rastafari beliefs and it's heavily rooted in sort of anti-corporate kind of political protest and messaging. And right. Virtue kind of fits into what I would call conscious music, that is, it's coming from a place of political and social almost righteousness, where you have something to say which is important and you have strong beliefs on things. It's now sort of fits in very well to what we're seeing in the way I view it. It's a bit of a renaissance in conscious music. There's now a lot of it out there, and it's sort of gaining more traction and it has a lot of followers. But the challenge always I find for protest music is that it don't get played on mainstream corporate radio ever. You don't ever hear it. I mean, there's maybe one show on the BBC in this country which sometimes plays some sort of protest conscious music, but there was a big case 2 years ago of a song by a band over here which was calling our Prime Minister a liar. And it made number one on the iTunes charts in the UK. BBC would not play it. They banned it, even though it's like number one, because it was slagging off the Prime Minister. I mean, do you think, for me, the fact that...
Well, that is a government-run thing, isn't it?
It is. I know. I mean, literally, this was number one in the UK, and the BBC would not play it. It was far too political for them. They can't possibly play something that's criticising the Prime Minister. It struggles to get played on mainstream radio. Now, for me, that's not so much of... It's not so much that it's a corporate issue that they won't play it, but I think it's because sort of protest and political music still doesn't break through into the public consciousness and as much as it needs to. It's still quite a niche kind of... Again, we're back to what we discussed in the news section about the group of people in society who are woke and everyone else who's sort of in a zombified stupor. Is that the case for you? Do you think that's why we don't hear so much protest music, just because it's not in the public psyche so much, as it were?
To me, I feel like it's not like all the artists know what's going on, and then, you know, and so there, it's like, you know, the civil rights era, and there's like this kind of, you know, literally black and white issue, and, you know, either you're talking about it or you're not. And it's like James Brown is talking about it, and you know, it's not like that. I think most artists probably like kind of watch CNN and like don't quite get the full. It's such a small percentage that I think really understand the whole. I mean, everyone kind of understands this money and the politics. I think I'm hoping people are going to eventually put it together. It seems like almost crazy at this point to not, but again, I think they're more obsessed in this country, for example, in America, like with, you know, the Trump thing. So it's like that's kind of what their news, you know, addiction is giving them and what they seek. So it's not really like solving the kind of, I mean, if they end up educating themselves on things through that, I suppose it's maybe good in the end, but it definitely seems to me like most even musicians are not, very few are kind of on that level. So you mentioned reggae, and I mean, Bob Marley is one of my favorite artists ever, so yeah, I think he did a good kind of almost like Jay-Z, like half serious and a half entertainment or something. I think I heard Jay-Z say that once a long time ago, but I guess there are artists like that, like hip-hop artists or, you know, maybe reggae artists that are more political, and I think that Yeah, I mean, race is a huge issue, so that's kind of like the main one, I suppose, that they're tackling, not to generalize, but just I feel like in terms of the full corporate, because race, again, is a thing that's just being used. It's not really, even though it's the biggest issue, I think the issue is almost above it. It's like, again, it's like money and politics. If you're actually going to solve the race issues, I think that would be like priority order number one, even though the race issue is, for me, the biggest issue. So in terms of that kind of level of kind of strategic political thinking, I think that there are activists out there and writers, but not many musicians, or at least not many mainstream ones. So it's not like, you know, musician X, who's very popular, has a political side and he gets blacklisted. I mean, he might, but it hasn't really even come to that point yet. So we'll see, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent way of summing the situation up, definitely. And yeah, I think it'll be very interesting, because politics is becoming so polarized. I think there will be more and more kind of protests and political artists sort of coming through, whether they get mainstream recognition, and as you say, whether actual mainstream artists themselves start coming out as more political than maybe they have in the past, we'll have to wait and see. But the Voids definitely are on the right side of that debate for me. I mean, just to wrap this up, 2019 then, so what is in store for the Voids? What can we expect? Is there more touring coming up this year?
We're going to be doing a bunch of one-off things, but no, just working on new music and pretty exciting. I'm excited by it.
Excellent. And anything from the Strokes this year, possibly?
I don't know, maybe. I mean, I feel like no headlines to offer, sorry, but I mean, I'm always working on a bunch of things, so, you know.
Excellent. Well, whatever you're doing, I'm sure it is going to be amazing. And you need to start talking politics more as well, please, because it's been absolutely fascinating, insightful, inspiring, and transfixing, just like Virtue by the Voids is speaking to you, Julian. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on my podcast. I've really enjoyed it, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. It's absolutely brilliant. Thanks to speak to you.
Thank you, man. This has been awesome, man. Keep up the great work, and I'll see you around. Maybe when I'm in foggy old London town, come by and we can shoot the breeze.
Absolutely, we may have to do that. Julian Casablancas, thank you. How amazing is Julian Casablancas? Oh my gosh. One of the best interviews I've done in a very long time. Now I want to play your track off the Voids album Virtue. It is the one I discussed with Julian. It is my favourite track. I think it's absolutely amazing, sensational work here. It's just beautiful. This is Think Before You Drink. The Voids, Think Before You Drink.
As a child, I had no knowledge, no way to understand. My father kept me sheltered, he would hold me in his hand. You know I was protected with no threat from anywhere. I drank my mother's milk, I didn't have a care, but it didn't. Explaining economic war.
And that's it. This very special episode of Top Line Caged is done. I would like to thank my fantastic guest, the sensational Julian Casablancas. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Casablancas_J. As always, behind the scenes, thank you to the love of my life, the gorgeous Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. My man in the booth, sound engineer Gav Paws. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Paws with a Z Radio. And last but not least, thank you to my in-house singer. It's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray_Star113. Thank you to the Canary for encaging me. Don't forget to join us. Become a member. I'm off to have a lie down after that marathon interview. I will see you very soon.
Uncaged.